Tell me about the stories that you write. Why do you choose to write plays?
So, as I was saying before, there are days I feel like playwriting also chose me as much as I chose it. I was always very drawn to theater. As a kid, I did a lot of music and dance, mm-hmm. and I was a huge reader, so I was always very drawn to story. And all through college, I tried a lot of different things, and I did equal amounts of writing and acting and directing, but when I looked back at the end of college, I realized I'd always been taking a playwriting class, and there was a way that could have stuck out to me. And I was super lucky my senior year, and I got mentored. I was very, very lucky I got to work with Paula Vogel. And something about working with her really got me excited about making playwriting my path.
Mm-hmm.
And then what was the other question? What stories do you write?
Yeah, what stories do you write?
So I'm learning I write different kinds of stories. And one branch is definitely like very heartfelt comedies, like big old-fashioned hilarious comedies. I think there are different kinds of humor, and I'm really interested in what I call behavioral humor, where it's like things are funny because people really are going after something, versus like just the words are funny, you know, or it's
mm-hmm.
ironic funny. I'm really interested in that much more heartfelt, earnest sort of I Love Lucy, Marx Brothers, I don't know, what's that called? There's a Kaufman and Hart play, You Can't Take It With You, that kind of world of comedy. I also write more like bittersweet dramas, and they tend to also be funny, maybe more dark funny, but and they tend to dive deeper into like the mysteries of human relationships and ask harder, more probing questions. And then I also write children's musicals, which I've just started doing these last couple of years, and that have been a great joy for me to find that part of my voice too.
So what's sort of the difference for you writing children's musicals versus adult plays geared towards adults?
You know, not as much difference as I thought there would be. Kids are really sharp, and in a way you have to be even cleaner and more on top of your storytelling with kids, I think, than with adults. And it's been really, I think it's helped my adult writing a ton to be writing for kids. Kids have a really low bullshit meter, and they, but they're also really game. So they're kind of like, they're great because they make you tell your most muscular, clean, you know, on top of it story, but they also like, sure, there's a sea monster. Sure, she doesn't have any gravity. What's next? You know, like they're open in a way that I actually think they inspire adults around them. I've watched adults at kids' plays. They're much more willing to like take leaps in ways that I think in adult plays, they're a little more grumpy. And I should check my phone and see if the boss and the other, you know.
Yeah.
I do think that, you know, depending on the age of the kids you're writing for, complexity varies. I'm a big fan of what my composer Mike and I like to call the Pixar model, which is like trying to write something that really, maybe we'd say like targeted ages, like 5 to 8 or something, but really all ages could get something out of it.
Yeah.
You know, I think more grown men love Toy Story 3 than like anybody else.
It's so true,
so.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I get excited because I think there's a theatricality and an entertaining nature of kids' theater that I think adult theater is often missing. And so I think for me right now, it's kind of just been great to get to work between the two mediums and kind of keep one form inspiring the other.
Yeah.
My favorite thing about writing for kids is that you might be writing the first play someone ever sees.
Yeah.
And I think that's pretty remarkable.
Oh, yeah. Have you actually ever talked to any of the kids in the audiences before?
I just didn't do this video. ART made a video of the kids after they saw the show.
Oh,
they loved it. They come see it 2-3 times. You know, they really get into it. It's exciting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Which writers do you take inspiration from?
So many. I mean, I always look first in my mentors. So I was so lucky, and I worked with some real goddesses of playwriting. I worked with Paula Vogel and Sarah Rule and Naomi Izuka, and very briefly with Maria Irene Fornes, and learned some great craft and mystery and writing and life. You know, they're sort of ladies that do it all. I also love Toni Kushner and Shakespeare and Thornton Wilder. I love anybody that can, like, figure out how to be lyrical, funny, and political. Like, I think that we don't think of political plays as lyrical or funny, or we don't think of funny plays. You know what I mean? Like all,
mm-hmm.
Tony Kushner did that with Angels, and I think we've all been, like, trying to figure out how to do it again since. I'm also inspired by some non-writers. Like, I think there's some amazing women directors, like Diane Paulus and Julie Taymor and Mary Zimmerman, that are bringing, like, theatricality back to the American theater and using mask and fun and lights and color and getting us back into the visual landscape of theater in a way that I think sometimes we forget. And
yeah, that's fascinating. I took the writing class with Melinda Lopez, and she was saying sort of the breakdown of, or I think of what Aristotle said was like the six things in plays, and one of them was spectacle, and I didn't really understand that until, like, you know, I saw The Tempest at ART. That was, like, so much spectacle, and I don't know, there's something about, because it's Shakespeare, but it's also, there's so much on stage that you can pay attention to without thinking, oh, wait, what are the words going in, you know? There's so much happening.
And I think, like, you know, if you're all spectacle and no story, you aren't my favorite kind of theater either, but I think right now we're tipped really far in, like, the realistic.
Yeah.
White people in a living room play, you know, and so it interests me, how do we get a little, like, because TV and film are so good right now, they are so good that it seems a shame for theater to try to compete with that on such a, you know, some realistic plays are awesome, and some plays that are realistic are my favorite plays, but I think, I don't know, like, we used to wear masks more, and song and dance was so much more common in plays, and kind of getting back to, not that every play should be a musical, but, like, but there's something, I don't know, a lot of my plays end up with a little music or a little dance in them, and I think it's because that's kind of what the stage is for.
Yeah.
It was like vaudeville and entertainment.
Yeah, and it's funny, I mean, with film, you know, you can switch from an airport instantly to the beach or something like that, but for, you know, a show, you're doing it in a different way, but, you know, it's, you can be more creative, I guess, because you're not relying on an airport sign or something like that.
Well, and the
like
change
that
becomes part of the show.
Yeah.
So it's like, is it a gazillion-dollar budget where there's a big moving set? Is it actually the scene changes, tell the story somehow?
Right.
You know, it's all inclusive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you remember the first play that sort of captivated you? I guess if you're thinking about, you know,
kids
that you're writing for.
I think it's I remember very little about it, but we saw a musical called Once on This Island.
Oh, yeah! Wow!
But I loved it. I mean, I grew up just outside of New York City, so I see a lot of shows and musicals growing up, but there's something about that one that was special. It stuck with me. We saw City of Angels, which is a great musical, and I remember there were, like, naked people on stage. It was just totally shocking to my, like, kid brain. But that's a really cool play, because it's two worlds. It's like a... Do you know it?
I've never read it. Yeah, no, I've never seen
it. It's an awesome piece. I wish it was somewhere than it is. But it's about a someone who writes detective stories. But it's like a two-world piece, so it's like his life, but it's also like his main detective, your watch. And so, like, the whole detective novel world is in black and white, and then the real life is in color. It's just like, it's a, visually, it's, it was a really cool piece. And the music is really fun, too. But, I think it's really the first two things I remember. Yeah, my sister and I, like, put on a million plays, like, in our basement, but, those are two that have stayed with me.
Do you think women writers tell different stories than men writers?
I think everyone tells different stories, and I think, you know, we were talking about this before, it's dangerous to oversimplify this question or undersimplify it in a way, and I think that, you know, the ingredients of what makes up your voice is so complex, because it's not just your gender, but it's your race, it's your background, it's your privilege, it's your religion. There's so many things, and I think what's exciting to me is we're starting to have more voices get heard, and I hope we keep moving that way. And I think that, you know, the conversation around gender parity is great, because it's opening up a big, you know, half the world is women, so it's opening up. But I think sometimes it's dangerous to start this conversation without also bringing in race, because then sometimes you just end up talking about white women. You know, it gets a little tricky. But it definitely, I think everyone tells different stories. I'm always interested in seeing multiple complex women on stage
mm-hmm.
in a play. I think that's sometimes something we lack, especially if we look at the biggest, like Broadway, those are the biggest things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, so I'm always happy when there are multiple complex women in things. I'm always happy when in a festival or in a season, a theater is just really making a point of having different kinds of voices. And I mean
mm-hmm.
that across like gender and race and class. Like,
yeah,
class is something we never talk about.
Yeah,
we should talk about more. So.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating that, I mean, to a certain extent, people talk about race, but class is a lot harder for people to talk about, and it's,
mm.
yeah. Are there any writers right now discussing gender in their work?
Yes, there are a lot. So, who did I think of before? So Melinda Lopez has this new awesome play called Becoming Cuba. It's a really cool historical women pharmacist in
mm-hmm.
Cuba at the center of that. I always am interested in Sarah Rule has sort of an interesting sort of compilation
yeah.
of women in each of her plays.
Eurydice, I love Eurydice.
I auditioned for like the first production of that.
You did?
She was a grad student and I was an undergrad and I got called back for Eurydice and it made my month.
That's amazing. So was she was a grad student and she started that show at that time?
Yes, she was
wow.
in the first place. She went to grad school and they did it at like the student theater and it was a great production. The play's changed a lot since then. There were more characters in it then, but I love that play. And I loved having seen it like from the beginning. And a lot of my friends were in it because we were all like,
wow.
we were like undergrads that were around like, doing things. Winter Miller, MJ Kaufman, I should think more about this, this is a great question. Like, Jose Riviera always has just, like, really complex characters all around, but always delighted to meet his women, because they're, like, not just one thing.
Yeah.
Lucy Thurber, probably doing interesting things. I don't know her work that well, but she is one of the few American players that really writes about class, and so I feel like as
mm-hmm.
a result, probably going to see some women in her plays that I don't always know. This is the one. Let me think more on this one. I'll definitely email you
okay.
some more names.
How would you define a strong woman character? Is it important for you to write strong women characters?
I just always have written a lot of women in my work, and it might be because it's my way in. You know, it's my lens.
Yeah.
I'm also just interested in, like, rich, complex characters. And so, you know, we have a history, maybe, of more complex men on stage than women. And
mm-hmm.
so it's exciting that we're in this time of looking for more complex or strong women characters. I think it's dangerous when strong means masculine or means just loud. You know, I think, like,
yeah.
I'm more interested in seeing more human and complex people on stage than...
Mm-hmm.
Just like replacing all the guys in Mammoth plays with women, you know, like I don't know that that's my answer to the gender parity question, but yeah, I think sometimes when we're at our worst, women can get really simplified in things, and so it's always interesting to me when that can become more, like that's what I loved about Melinda's play, was that
yeah.
it was this pharmacist during the revolution, Cuba, husband, and she was a lover, and she, like, it was just so many pieces. It felt more like a real person.
Yeah.
Yeah, as I'm starting to watch my friends have kids too, it feels like motherhood is a big component, a possible component of being a woman, and it's interesting to me how we do or don't see that
mm-hmm.
story on stage.
Yeah. No, you said before that, you know, if a woman is just on stage to be the mother, what
right.
that does
right.
for her as a character and for, you know, the situation itself.
Oh, right. We were talking about Fun Home. Right.
Yeah,
so Fun Home. I think Lisa Crumb is a great woman on stage, and
yeah.
that's one of them. And in Fun Home, you know, there's, like, this awesome, strong, very strong, like, lesbian heroine. But there's also her mom, who's, like, kind of straight out of the 50s in
yeah.
some ways, and she's a different kind of strong female character. She's that amazing solo we were talking about.
Yeah.
Kills you.
yeah.
And, like, this isn't a play, but I just rewatched Frozen last
oh,
week
because yeah.
we were working on this kids thing, and I like to kind of see other kids. And, like, what I loved about Frozen was that it had two wonderful and flawed females at the center of it. And I think that to me is strong, more
mm-hmm.
than like them being perfect, you know, more like two women you might know, you know, in one way or another.
Yeah.
And that the real love story of that was between sisters really kind of got me. I love that.
Yeah. Have you ever started writing a play and the gender of a main character changed during your writing process?
I have written scenes. It hasn't come to play about characters that are, like, wondering if they're trans or know they're trans. And that interests me. I also am right now working on an adaptation for kids of Twelfth Night,
mm-hmm.
where the Orsino character is, like, a pirate. So the Violet character not only has to pretend to be a man, she has to pretend to be a pirate.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been really fun to get to kind of play with how do you perform being male, how do you perform being a pirate, how do you, you know.
Yeah.
That's been a good lesson for me.
Actually, I mean, it's really cool because, you know, when you think about children and what they're watching and, you know, you see so many princesses and but the
mm-hmm.
idea that Viola could be a pirate would be so, you know, fascinating to see little kids watch, you
yeah.
know? Because
yeah.
she can embrace just doing other things. And,
no,
you know,
there's a whole,
history.
Like, how to be a pirate test and, like,
yeah.
you have to fart and belch and she does all of it, you know, kind of
yeah.
great, I think, to break down some of the assumed boy and girl stuff. And then her brother, Sebastian, we have being, like, a little more delicate and a little more bookish. And I like it. I like it. We're kind of... And, like, Mike, my composer, wrote the first big Viola song. And it's, like, her I Want song. And it's called Man Up. And it's, like, really fun and kind of like a rock song. And I like it. I like that we're kind of playing with a woman being strong on stage, but also she falls in love. She makes mistakes. She misses her brother, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, well, how old is the Viola character going to be? Is she going to be, like, is she a younger kid or is she older?
We're playing with, like, 16, 17. 20, old enough to, like, fall in love with a pirate king.
Yeah.
That seems sketchy.
Yeah.
just jumping back, like, 8 questions. I've been really kind of obsessed with Good Wife recently.
Mm.
You know that TV show?
I've never seen it, no.
Talk about women characters. They do a really... I know you're thinking mostly about
no,
her,
no,
but I just have loved it so much. And like anything, you know, it has its ups and downs, but they're just, like, a couple of really different, really complex, strong,
mm.
funny, flawed women on it, and I just love that about
mm.
it. So,
do you watch Orange Is the New Black?
Yeah,
yeah.
Do
you like that show?
I love that show. I haven't seen the second season yet.
Oh,
I watched
it's
the first
so good.
Season.
Yeah,
the first couple episodes, I was like, because it felt a little bit like, oh, rich white lady goes to jail. But once they kind of,
yeah, I think the most fascinating part is the background stories where you
yeah.
see how each woman got into the situation.
And
that she
becomes is a little more humble as it goes on too.
Yeah,
and then you could. It was easier for me to.
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah, no, I mean, I don't think I've ever seen so many women in something. I love that.
Yeah.
And, you know, I understand, too, that we're still at a point where, like, you'd have to put, like, a white upper-class lady at the center of that show for it to...
That's a good point, yeah.
...get sold, but, hey, it's doing good. It's
yeah.
doing a lot of good right now.
If or when during the writing process do you start thinking about the audience, do you feel you write for a certain audience?
I'm like a total laugh whore, so I think I start thinking about the audience from like moment one. I'm always pretty aware there's an audience. Sometimes, you know, if I'm really trying to work out an idea or a moment, I'll let go of the audience, I think, and really just explore something and then know it may have to get trimmed or sort of rethought. But I don't know, I feel like the audience is your main scene partner.
Mm.
I don't know if Ann Bogart wrote this or said this, but like, as a director, you have two ensembles, like you're actors in your audience,
mm.
and I feel like as a writer, it's the same truth. It's like you have to, I don't know, I get so frustrated when people get angry
mm.
at the audience, because I think that, like, they're our allies, and they're actually what make this our art form possible, and,
mm-hmm.
you know, if people start, like, waving their fists about, like, the blue hairs and the old people, and it's like, well, but they're not actually the problem. The problem is who can afford to go to theater. Not,
yeah.
Like, the people that are going to theater are actually helping the theater.
Yeah.
It's like, how can we get more people there or have different kinds of... Oh, I was saying this before. I'm always interested in theater that's not in theaters, too. Like, how do you bring theater into schools or
mm-hmm.
parks or hospitals to get it to people that probably need it and also might not have the money or the privilege or the access to just, like, show up on 42nd Street and, you know.
Yeah, it's fascinating because I'm doing work with Company One this summer and we're looking at data and sort of the intrinsic impact of theater. And it's so fascinating because it's you can see clearly through the statistics that the people who are the most really captivated by the shows are first timers. Like they, you know, maybe it's not their first time in a theater, but it's their first time seeing a show by Company One, or, you know, maybe it is their first time in the theater. But like that means a lot that those are the people who are really captivated the most because, you know, I don't know what was not letting them into theater. Maybe it was finances, maybe it was something else, maybe it was just preference, but, you know.
Well, Company One also does a great job of having all different kinds of programming for all different kinds of people.
Yeah.
I think it's terrific.
Yeah. So no, I find that really interesting. What kind of theater do you think is the easiest to get produced? Do you ever feel pressured to create plays that fit in with this mold? This is the start to the part that we didn't get to.
Yes. did I not say anything again that you liked? I mean, I think straight, white, hetero, somewhat money stories are what we see a lot of. Which isn't to say some of them, I think some of them are, I love Other Desert Cities, which exactly fits everything I just said, you know, but, so I'm not criticizing any play that has those ingredients. I probably have a play or two myself that has exactly those ingredients, but I think small cast, but I don't know any producers, like, producers are always looking for exciting projects and good projects, and projects that will sell, right? So it's, I don't know, I think we're always so ready to demonize people within our industry.
And I
think it's important for everyone to be accountable. But I also think, like, compassion can go a long way in terms of helping the theater grow, and, like, it's awesome the Company One is looking at data, that's actually going to help them figure out, you know, how they can move laterally in this great system they've set up. And so, yeah, I mean, sure, coming out of grad school, I had some agent I talked to that was like, your next play should have 4 characters, you know?
Wow, that's so specific.
I know, and because my plays tended to be bigger.
Yeah.
And I wrote a play with 4 characters, and it's never been done. So, you know,
right.
I don't know
that
any of those formulas solve anything. You know, I do understand, and it's taken me, I've grown up enough now to understand that, you know, like, theater is a business, and that a theater is taking a financial risk on anything it does.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I've noticed just trend-wise that a lot of playwrights' first play that gets some attention are sometimes smaller cast plays. And for a long time I thought, now I am actually writing a 2-character play for the first time, but it was something I genuinely wanted to write. And the characters that play, you know, a ton of roles within it. And so it's a fun, it still has, like, sort of signature, like, Lila Rose theatricality all over it. So there's something to, like, a little bit of savvy about the market that is helpful, but I also think, like, it's important to write your huge plays, too.
Yeah.
I'm moving away from, I think right out of grad school it was a lot of, like, send everything everywhere. I know I'm much more interested in looking for partnerships, looking for the right collaborator, looking for the people that will help me realize the thing I'm already doing versus, like, trying to write the thing that will get a particular slot, and that's been a really good shift for me. When I moved, I've been in California for a while, and I moved here to Boston about 2 years ago, and I remember, I don't know if you have this, but for me, every move has some, like, a resolution or to what is this chapter, and I was like, I think I need to start focusing more on relationships and productions. So less on, like, applying for everything and trying to kind of get everybody's attention, and more like, you know, what are the relationships, artistic relationships I really want to deepen, what are some I want to begin, and what are the production needs? The plays I've written, how can I find them productions? You know, and that's been a great, and I've, with that shift, like, a ton of work has come my way. So it's been a really good lesson in, like, sort of shifting your focus to.
Do you feel that with ART? Because, you know, you had your play before
that,
and
was
then
such
again
a
soon.
Gift. I, you know, my composer, Mike Petrie, and I wrote this musical a couple of years ago, and people are like, you're crazy, you don't have a commission, why are you writing a musical? And I was like, you know, I grew up loving musicals, I've never written one. Kids one feels like a better size one to start with because they're like an hour or 75 minutes, not a whole one. And theaters are always looking for kids musicals, whereas like theaters are not always looking for adult musicals. So and we wrote it, and I honestly didn't know if it ever happened. It was like, maybe Light Princess is just our calling card to kind of get a commission or get a project. And then coming here, I met with Allegra, who's their resident director, about a different project. And then she's like, you know, I'm looking for a children's musical. Do you have one? And I was like, I do. And it was amazing. Like,
wow.
In like 3 weeks, they were going to do it. It was like, it's sort of very, this goes to show you have to always just, you know, keep meeting people.
Yeah.
yeah, and now we have this great relationship with them and with Nuvik in New York, and feels like this could be a partnership that lasts for a while, where like we write them.
That's so great.
Stuff, so, yeah, and I think it's, you know, like any relationship, time deepens it, and so I'm all about it. I always love meeting new people, but I'm also realizing that I've got some real wonderful collaborators already in my tribe, and to kind of get to know them better and work more with them.
So I have two more questions for you. One is, what's one piece of advice you give to a young or less experienced woman playwright?
Specifically around parody or just in general?
I mean, in general, things that you've sort of picked up that you wish you knew.
Make sure your world is bigger than theater. I think especially when you're starting out, you know, theater is addictive and it's amazing and you can kind of get like swept into it. But the best art and the best artists, I think, are actually in the world making art, ask questions or push back or, you know, like, so I think making sure that you are part of a larger world than just a world of theater. I think it's really good to work with directors of both genders. I think sometimes theaters can pair young women directors with young women playwrights. And that can be great. Some of my best friends and best directors are young women directors. But there is just something to kind of making sure you're working with a bunch of different people.
Yeah.
That's, I think, important to kind of get different perspectives on your work and different aged people. You know, I think it's a gift to have collaborators your age. It's also a gift to work with someone who actually is a grandma, and then suddenly they have a very different perspective on the, you know, the mom in your play. And I think see a lot and do a lot, but never doubt the story you want to tell. Like, I think I definitely went through a phase of, like, after grad school, like, trying to write, kind of like your other question was, like, trying to write the right play to get produced, and I'm happy where that play's landed, but it never had that rush of, like, I'm writing, you know, whatever my questions are, my challenges, or my, you know, it didn't quite have that shimmer to it, but, like, other projects I'm working on now do. And challenge yourself. I always think that's a good one. I'd still have fun.
And then my last question is, what would gender parity in the theater look like to you?
I mean, I think it would mean not having the conversation anymore. because we felt like we didn't need to, not because we've gotten tired of it or something. I think it would be a mix of voices and characters for me. So I think it would be a real, you know, really strong presence of women on all levels of theater, all levels of playwriting, so from the most fringy to the most Broadway West End, you know. I think it would be different kinds of women, so women of different, like, remember, races or classes or backgrounds or trans, you know, kind of making sure that our women playwrights don't all look exactly like me, which could happen. I think it would also mean a parity among characters that are produced, like the plays themselves, so having these different kinds of complex women represented. And also making sure that we still have good men in our theaters and in our work and in our, you know, I'm always, I think it's important to have complex men in things too, and to make sure we're asking ourselves the same questions about our male characters as we are about our female characters.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And I think that finding a way to empower men in this conversation, I think, would be part of gender parity. I know that I can imagine it's probably easy to feel like you can't say anything as a man in this conversation. I don't think that is useful.
Like, right.
We want to empower everybody to do good work. And, you know, I'm sure you heard about the summit and the
Yeah.
the pipeline and the we want to get away from falling victim to those sorts of conversations and more towards the model of, like, the Kilroys and, you know, them.
Yeah.
Who are like, fuck it, we're going to do something. Here's a list of 300 plays you can do, you know, which is different than, like, well, what do you mean? You know, it's like, I think actually, because historically women can have been the victim in so many ways, I think it's so great in plays and in life when women can just take action. Because I think that to me has something to do with parody, where feeling you have the right to take action.
Yeah.
You know, is a big thing. And I also think, and I said this at the our little, like, gender parody thing here in Boston I went to, like,
April? Was it April?
I think it was in April. I've gotten much more into, like, mindfulness and thinking about, like, Buddhism and compassion in these last years or two. And I think, like, being strong and fighting for gender parity and also remembering that everybody in the conversation is a person, you know, and that the best way to get things done is by building things, not breaking things.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes people who've been in this fight much longer than I have, you know, can get so frustrated that it's just about, like, tearing down what exists. But, like, to most of the world, we're all, like, the weird theater people, you know? Like, to most of the world, this isn't a pressing problem. So to figure out how to, like, connect with the people within our industry to make change. And then also, this is something we talked about, like, how do you branch out of theater to women who care about women's stories in other fields and other universes? And be like, hey, like, Alana or someone had a great idea, which was, like, how do we get, like, women's groups to have, like, their theater night? Or how, like, kind of, like, how do you...
Yeah.
Not just try to solve this from the inside, but also from the outside. Like, you can prove to a theater you could sell out a show that's all female. Like, that's kind of the data thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, data is your best friend, I think, in this kind of conversation.
Yeah, and I was just thinking about, you know, women as leaders, you know, that's across all fields, you know? Like, that's directors, whatever. Mm-hmm. But then it's also, like, women as doctors, lawyers, whatever. But, you know, that's something that we can all connect to, so...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I can't think of anything else. I think that's all. I want to think of more writers who are doing interesting things with gender. So I'll send you an email. Jen Haley is another one. She's doing
Jen
cool
Haley.
Stuff. Yeah.
Is there anything else you want me to add? I mean, do you want to add?
I don't think so. I can't think of anything got lost in translation. No, if you need anything else, though, please email me. It's such a delight to think about this stuff and
Yeah.
talk about it.